and welcome to Tech Weekly, the Guardian's technology podcast for the week beginning the 15th of March, 2010. This week, we're dipping our toes into the pool of politics, dissecting the latest techno-rhetoric from both sides of the Atlantic here in the UK and in the US that have been floating around the web. Joining me are the perfect pair to get their feet wet, The Guardian's online political correspondent, Kevin Anderson, and our San Francisco-based technology correspondent, Bobby Johnson. Welcome to you both. Kevin, have I got your title right? Because it's a moving target.
It is a moving target. I just say now that I'm the person who collects job titles that don't make sense. But I mean, this one actually makes some amount of sense, so maybe I'm losing my niche.
Maybe I should be in charge of making up those job titles.
Just pull it out of a hat from now on.
Okay. Bobby, your job title is soon to disappear. I understand that this is your last Tech Weekly recording with us.
I think so, yeah. In a week or two, I'm going to be off. I think I'll take on a job title like Wizard or something.
Well, you are in Silicon Valley area, so it's only appropriate. You can be the CEO of Wizardry and the Grand Poobah of something or other.
Well, Chris Messina has gone to Google, so I think Ginormous Monkey Tamer is going.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I'll give that one a go.
Go for that, Bobby. Go for that. Well, in this program, we'll be looking at the latest web toy that's enraptured the White House, an opinion barometer that takes the pulse of the world on U.S. foreign policy.
It's showing that even though there may be the classic 20th century walls around how we think about foreign policy, we can use 21st century tools to throw ideas over those and eventually make those much more transparent.
And we'll be taking our own pulse on issues closer to home, including the Conservative Party's technology manifesto released last week and a detailed account of the implications for Labour's proposed digital economy bill. We'll spare you the invective, but we may be heavy on the rhetoric. Don't let that put you off. Stick around for 30 minutes of Tech Weekly.
Tech Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
First, here are the big stories from the world of technology this week. Bobby, you reported on The Guardian today that the social networking site MySpace is determined to topple the Goliath Facebook. The website, owned by Rupert Murdoch's News International, is still struggling to maintain market share after the college-based Facebook took its crown. Now a music cul-de-sac, even this unique selling point is beginning to fracture as bands migrate to Facebook's cleaner design and larger user base. Bobby, how do MySpace plan on doing it?
Well, I think toppling Facebook is probably putting it a bit strongly because MySpace has really lost a lot of momentum in the past few years, and they've changed bosses a couple of times. What's happened this week is basically Jason Hirschhorn and Mike Jones, who have taken over as the co-presidents of MySpace, spent some time with me and some other reporters over the course of last week talking about the future and what they plan to do. And essentially, it's to try and reinvigorate MySpace as really a sort of a media website. If Facebook has succeeded by being the place you go and connect to people, they think MySpace is the place. They can bring back that sense of MySpace being the place that you go to see movies and listen to music and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, what's interesting actually is not just that, you know, they're trying to position themselves as perhaps a content consuming device, but I've heard from researchers like Dana Boyd, who's at Harvard and at Microsoft, that there are different people of socioeconomic statuses. There's a sort of demographic difference between, say, the MySpace, which tends to be a working class group, and the Facebook, which tends to be of a higher socioeconomic status. So I'm wondering, Kevin, there's a lot of social networking sites that are really trying to focus, you know, their specific intentions because they realize that this is quite an important thing to become a leader in a market share that's very, very driven and very specified. Isn't there room for both MySpace and for Facebook if MySpace is able to really focus on that content consumption?
Yeah, I mean, there is. And I think what's interesting about this is the idea of focusing on content. This isn't the first time that MySpace has actually tried to refocus on that, or the first social network. I mean, Bebo. Remember Bebo? I mean, that's what they tried to do with Cape Modern, was again try to be a content-focused social network. The strange thing is some of the remnants from social networks past still exist. So Friendster's still out there. Orkut is still out there, big in Brazil. So, I mean, some of them have moved on to sort of carve out a niche in other countries. So it isn't a winner-take-all per se, but definitely I'd have to agree with Bobby. I mean, in terms of momentum, you know, MySpace is definitely it has to kind of get its mojo back.
Bobby, how much would you say the relationship with News Corp affected the site's standing?
I think in the first instance, it probably didn't make that much difference. It just gave MySpace a bit more money in sort of 2005, 2006 to get bigger. What's interesting is what's happened over the past few years is there was a sort of distance between News Corp and MySpace. They didn't want too much interference from the rest of the business. Now, because they're going for this big media strategy, they're looking at News Corp and saying, bloody hell, you know, here's a company that owns TV stations, networks, newspapers, has good links with a whole bunch of media companies. Maybe we can use that to our advantage. It seems astonishing, really, that it's taken them so many years to realize what's sitting on their doorstep.
Does that suggest, though, Bobby, that this isn't going to cost a huge amount, this rebranding exercise?
They've been undergoing it for probably this latest sort of reworking for about a year, and they'll be rolling it out as this year goes on. So, you know, a huge amount of time and energy has gone into it. But I think it's all about partnerships and not necessarily vast amounts of money spent on securing deals, but big partnerships. I mean, you know, the site still has, they claim, and the figures seem to back it up, around 100 million users worldwide. That's not a small audience. So they're hoping that they can really sell this to media companies as a way to sort of connect with kids, which is what it always was, but sort of got lost along the way as they sort of tried to fight Facebook and stay number one.
Connecting with kids who are connecting with one another. What a lovely thought. Kevin, do you think that this influx of cash, of intention, of rebranding, do you think it's actually going to work?
Well, the thing that I would be concerned about is, you know, rebranding. It goes down really well in the capital of brand, London. But unless they return the attention to the users, it ain't going to fly.
Very interesting. Well, we shall keep an eye on this one. Now, election season has officially started in the UK, with both parties ramping up their social network strategies. In the past week, the Conservative Party laid out what they propose for the British technology sector, including a high-speed broadband strategy to rural Britain that they argue will create 600,000 new jobs. Why? Well, and I'm going to quote the manifesto here, they want to, quote, make the British government the most technology-friendly in the world and meet our ambition that the next generation of Googles, Microsofts, Facebooks are British companies. Technology, you see, is the economic buzzword of the 20-teens. Kevin, what are the key points in the Conservatives' technology manifesto?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's trying to do one-upsmanship with Labour. So, of course, we've got the Digital Britain Report, which promises to bring 2 megabits per second to everyone. And the Tories say, we're going to bring 100 megabits per second to most people. Now, the most people is that really interesting bit. And you can kind of see where they're going with this when they flag up South Korea and Singapore. Now, Singapore is a nation state. They don't have rural areas, so they don't have, you know, long distances to cover. South Korea's got one of the, you know, highest population densities in the world as well. Most people already live in cities. It's easy to wire up cities. It's not so easy to wire up Wales, for instance. Lots of rural areas, and it's difficult to pull fiber out there. So there's some devil in that details. You know, they also talk about a government skunk works, basically a part of the government that'll sort of do digital innovation and, you know, launch kind of digital innovated low-cost projects. And I think the one thing that's interesting, and a lot of people noted this, is right now the digital economy bill that's moving its way with pace through Parliament, or at least the House of Lords, is very heavy on copyright. There's only one paragraph that mentions rights or anti-piracy in the whole manifesto. And what it does say is that protecting businesses shouldn't get in the way of innovation.
We're going to be speaking about the digital economy bill in just a second, but I wanted to pull in something that Charles Arthur mentioned. He wrote a post today on the technology blog that said that the rural Tories are the people who aren't going to be getting the benefit of the proposed broadband. And what he says is that though the Tory tech manifesto says that it would create a public right to data, which is an innovative use of government data, they don't actually say that they would, for example, make ordnance survey maps data available for free. And it also, he says, it's completely unspecified what they would do with trading funds such as the Met Office, Ordnance Survey, Companies House, Land Registry, UK Hydrographic Office, etc. And he argues that it's not a manifesto on that basis. It's more like a vague hand-wringing. Bobby, from your side of the proverbial pond, apologies, what would you say to that? Do you think Charles is spot on?
He's completely on point. I mean, what we're seeing as the parties ramp up for an election is these sort of vague promises of a future. We don't exactly know how they're going to deliver what they're doing. I think what we're seeing from the Tories is this sort of Googleization. They're really keen on using Google and the sort of halo that brings to businesses. They want to use that and say, you know, we're an open, future-facing government. We are everything that Labour isn't. And David Cameron sort of is trying to capture that. Whether it's true or not, I mean, you can make your own decision. But I think we're in a game of politics here rather than policies.
Well, over on the blog that Charles wrote today, the post that he wrote today, Free Trademark comments, he says, none of the parties have ever grasped just how important high-speed broadband is to the rural economy, because most of the politicians have no understanding of how important it is to the businesses who try to exist in these rural areas. I suspect that it was very much the same when the telephone was invented in the 19th century. Politicians have never really grasped the internet other than the vague impression that it might be used as a tool for undermining the cozy relationship that they enjoy with established media. Well, I'd like to scoot over now to the left and speak about Labour's plans. Their proposed digital economy bill, the source of grumbling from around the British blogosphere, has received some high-profile criticism. Last week, British Telecom's chief executive, Ian Livingstone, added his voice to the chorus of other top corporate critics like Google and Facebook, who argue that the illegal file-sharing policy proposed in the version currently being debated in Parliament favours the music industry rather than other online content providers as a whole. Now, personally, I am still completely overwhelmed by all of the flinging of cream pies that's been going around the blogosphere. And I literally cannot tell heads or tails from what actually is in the bill. Bobby, can you explain exactly what the digital economy bill proposes?
Yeah, okay. It is very confusing. And when you watch what's going on in Parliament, it doesn't really make it any clearer. But there are lots of different parts to the digital economy bill. They cover all sorts of businesses, business aspects and regulatory aspects. They cover things like broadband, digital radio, spectrum, sell-off, lots of different things. The controversial parts are Clause 17, which effectively gave government the ability to change copyright law without parliamentary assent. That clause has now been pushed out. And won't be in the bill anymore. And there was also Amendment 120A, which was inserted by the Lib Dems. Now, that caused controversy because it wants to give the High Court the ability to issue an injunction against, say, a website or a web host if they host a substantial amount of copyright-infringing material. Now, that's something that's caused a lot of upset because it's sort of a British equivalent of the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US, which has caused all kinds of problems and been seen really as something that the copyright industry, you know, those people who are really trying to crack down on innovative uses of media on the web, it's caused them all kinds of problems. So those are the two things. Clause 17 has been dumped. Amendment 120 has actually, the Lib Dems have said they want to change it now because they've realised that it maybe is not going to work that well. And the government has actually said that it wants to make its own change to that, but that it will do it when the bill comes to the House of Commons in the next couple of weeks.
Kevin, you spoke about the copyright issues before, and as Bobby said, that element has been dumped from the digital economy bill as it's being put through now. But I'm wondering if you could talk me through some of the other regulation issues, content regulation issues.
Yeah, and one thing I would say to Bobby's comment about DMCA, which I know a lot about, is that the DMCA in the States actually takes down material where the original formulation of 120A was to take down the entire website. So it was a much broader based, as I read it, attack. It was just saying not just remove the content that was infringing, but actually just block the site fully.
And the content regulation in terms of how they would, how it would play out in this country, how do they propose? Is that to do with this idea of three strikes and you're out?
Well, there's the three strikes. Now, that was basically that anyone who, an individual who was accused of infringing three times would have their connection curtailed potentially. Now, there are lots of issues around that over whether the sufficient due process was still in place so that, you know, you didn't basically have the broadband police that would just turn off your connection at the request of a copyright owner. And there were serious concerns about that. So that there were lots of changes to the copyright law. And I have to say, if you look just on the balance of the material, it was about 70% to deal with rights. And about 30% of the bill actually dealt with things like inserting the government in domain registration, which is very strange.
Now, this the word economy is in this bill. And I keep hearing about, you know, three strikes and you're out, you'll switch it off, and this idea of regulation and copyright, which we've already spoken about. How, Kevin, will this bill promote the British economy?
Critics of the bill will say that this is about protecting the creative industries. Now, creative industries have become this important catch-all for the movie, music, and to some extent publishers, those industries. But it's not really – when you look at the bill, there's not a lot in there of what probably listeners to the Tech Weekly podcast would consider technology companies. In terms of you know, what this does to create a British Google or the next generation of British technology startups, apart from delivering 2 megabits of broadband to everyone, there's not a lot.
Bobby, you mentioned the DMCA already and how that has a similar remit in the U.S. Can you tell me about any outcomes that have come forth from implementation?
If you go and look at the DMCA, which has been around in, it was passed in 1998 in the US and sort of brought in the early 2000s, nothing has changed. There's still an awful lot of file sharing and copyright infringement. It doesn't really seem to do a lot for that. What it does allow is companies to suppress embarrassing documents by claiming copyright over them if they get published online. It's still illegal to circumvent digital rights, even for your own personal purposes. And that even stretches to things like mobile phone unlocking. These things are still illegal in the US, and they don't seem to really have changed the landscape at all. So it's hard to see what the digital economy bill is going to do for Britain. The real worry, and this is what a lot of the parliamentarians who have voiced concerns about it as well, is that this is really being rushed through. It's going through its readings in the House of Lords extremely quickly. The government are going to try and get it put through the House of Commons as soon as they can, because they want to enact this before the election and before Parliament dissolves. And there are still so many questions that are unanswered. Legislation shouldn't be rushed through. It shouldn't be passed through as quickly as possible to beat an election timetable.
Well, from regulation and closing in on the digital economy, we're going to expand and say, hooray, let's celebrate the internet and the web. It's an honor that has been bestowed on over 120 international diplomats and organizations as varied as the UN, US President Jimmy Carter, and Médecins Sans Frontières. It's the Nobel Peace Prize, and it's been awarded 90 times. This year, there are over 230 nominations, including the internet. Far from being a hat thrown in at the last minute, the infrastructure that underlies what we know as the World Wide Web has been backed by former Nobel Peace Prize laureates and charitable do-gooders. But after the criticism levied against the Nobel jury for giving US President Barack Obama what many felt was the nod too soon, would a Peace Prize for the net undermine the power that this accolade has had? Bobby, what do you think?
I've got two words on whether the Nobel Peace Prize means anything. Henry and Kissinger. Just take that away with you.
Kevin?
You know, will cable news kind of spend 24 hours arguing who is more unworthy, the internet or Barack Obama?
Well, more information on all these stories, including links and commentary about the digital economy bill and the Conservative Party manifesto, are at guardian.co.uk/technology. The information funnel that connects the public and elected representatives is tantamount in a democratic system. Over the years, democratic governments have played around with a huge variety of opinion-gathering devices. Most involve face-to-face focus groups, telephone polls, and postal surveys. But in recent years, the potential of the web for use as a public barometer has not gone unnoticed by political bodies, and they've occasionally enthusiastically tried on a variety of Web 2.0 technologies for communication. Now, a new system has been adopted by the U.S. State Department to scrape opinions on its most important foreign policy issues, not only from its own citizens, but from the worldwide audience. Quite a feat in public diplomacy. The service, called Opinion Space, was launched recently and features what it's describing as an innovative statistical mechanism that offers feedback to the people who share their views on a variety of big ideas. Kevin met Opinion Space co-founder Ari Wallach at last week's Alliance of Youth Movement in London and began by asking him what kinds of opinions he and the U.S. State Department are trying to solicit.
We're asking people, you know, their thinking around nuclear weapons, the threat to the U.S., the role of empowering women in terms of development, what is the role of climate change vis-a-vis national security, both for the U.S. and other countries. It's very broad for the launch of Opinion Space, and we want it to be that way because we want to cast a very wide net. And in the coming months, we'll be releasing kind of separate versions of questions for different opinions, and we'll drill down to something very specific if it happens to, let's say, connect with an impending trip Secretary Clinton is going on, or if there's a major issue that's kind of bubbling up and, you know, the State Department wants to get a sense of where the world is at, we will also float that up as well.
What are some of the questions you're asking?
So on the opinions space itself, there's the questions are kind of grouped into two kind of verticals. One is basically sliders. I agree to disagree. The first one is, I feel nuclear weapons are probably the largest terrorist threat facing the U.S. Another one is, I feel the biggest issue in terms of development is the education and empowerment of girls and women. So, again, very, very broad questions. And the second, which is kind of the essay portion of the question, is if you could say one thing to Secretary Clinton, what would it be? Why is it important? And any suggestions for follow-up? So this seems, it's obviously very broad, but even though we've had the site up just in beta just for a couple of days while we're working the kinks out, we've had over 1,000 different responses from people. Everything from, it's really important that we enact a stronger ban on whaling, to going back to these other things, questions about food production, global climate change, kind of spanning the entire gamut.
So obviously they want to solicit public opinion. What else do they hope to get out of it?
Typically for the past 100, 200 years, it's always been two people in suits over scotch talking about how they're going to do this or that vis-a-vis the other country. And in this 21st century statecraft policy that Secretary Clinton has laid out, the idea is not just government to government, but government to people and people to people and people to government. So kind of a new matrix of thinking about how we interact with one another. And one of the great things is after you've gone through the opinion space process, there's a little glowing dot that shows you where you are, but also allows you to see where other people are as well. So this isn't just an info gathering tool for the State Department. It's an info gathering tool for everyone who's using it. So what we want people to get out of it is, A, the U.S. State Department is listening, but B, here are some other opinions. Here are some people who think like you. And by the way, here's some people who don't think like you, but maybe do on one or two areas, but not on one or two of the other questions. So what we're seeing is people will answer the questions, they'll see where they are on the map, but then they'll spend 20, 30, 40 minutes reading other people's opinions, especially in terms of what they would tell Secretary Clinton.
So, you know, a lot of times when we think of opinion sites online, we think of you know, lots of light and heat and not necessarily a lot of enlightenment.
Yeah.
I mean, how is this – how did you kind of build this so that it's trying to get actually kind of opinions and insight rather than just sort of fighting the same old fights, you know, we've had online all the time?
There's basically two ways of being scored in the system. One is the top author and another is the top reviewer. And so what this allows people to do is look at other people's responses, say how much they agree or disagree with them, and that has them go up in the ranking as a reviewer. And on the flip side, there's the top authors. So kind of when more people agree with that than not, it also allows that to bubble up. And that system allows us to aggregate kind of the best, most enlightening thinking. So, you know, the follow-up question to that is, well, what's to prevent thousands of people going and almost like Google bombing and rising up one of the questions that is just not enlightening, but is still, they got 1,000 of their friends to bubble up something. Look, that could happen, but that's why this is an experiment. And over the coming months and hopefully years, we'll be refining it to kind of work that out. You know, in a few years, there'll be video on this. There'll be a better usage of Facebook and Twitter. But right now, very much in line with kind of the technological aesthetic of the day, it's don't wait for something to become perfect. Put it out there, see how people use it, how it works, and maybe how it doesn't work, and refine along the way.
Part of this is you know, a conduit to the U.S. State Department. Yeah. How is this connected back into how the U.S. State Department's going to operate?
You know, for it to actually have its doors open and allow people to be interacting on its website, I'm sure at first kind of freaked some people out, but in and of itself, it's ushering in a completely new way of thinking about openness in government. I mean, look, one of the models here is what's been happening in the UK with open government initiatives. You know, we're watching from across the pond and how you're opening up massive data sets and stores interacting, and, you know, there's great lessons to be learned there, and we recognize that as well. So it's showing that even though there may be, you know, the classic 20th century walls around how we think about foreign policy, we can use 21st century tools to throw ideas over those and eventually make those much more transparent. The opinion space itself was created by Ken Goldberg at UC Berkeley. He's the director of the Berkeley Center for New Media. So opinion space itself is actually semi-open source. So in the coming months, you will probably see a version of this crop up on other websites to allow information and opinions to be gathered, maybe not just on foreign policy issues, but, you know, ideally on other government websites as well. So it becomes this aggregator and experiment around opinion itself.
That was Opinion Space co-founder Ari Wallach. Kevin, what appeals to you about Opinion Space the most?
Well, obviously they're soliciting opinion, but they're going about it in a much more sophisticated way than just kind of a virtual suggestion box or, you know, let's have a yet another pointless conversation about, you know, Middle East peace that kind of devolves into a flame war within 5 seconds. So what they've done is they've abstracted your opinion slightly. So it's not that it doesn't have any value judgments. You obviously can see people who are grouped in like opinions, but it definitely is trying to get past the kind of typical flame war type of discussions that often happen around these very sensitive issues. So I think, you know, they've obviously thought a lot about a different way to gather opinion and for people to discuss these topics, some of which are really sensitive and explosive.
I had a play with it, and I have to say I wasn't particularly taken. And I think the reason is because I found the methodology a little bit suspect. Who decides what questions are put up there? Who decides what, you know, the policies that they're going to be discussing? Who decides how they're worded? Who decides in which order the questions go up? I mean, all of these things have an effect on people's opinions. And I think that there's potential for manipulation on the part of those people who are organizing it behind the scenes. Now, that's a methodological niggle. But I think more to the point, you say that it's a new way of representing and of creating dialogue. But how is it actually different from those web surveys that you get around election time that tell you, right, yes, you should vote in this way because you answered these six questions in this way. Therefore, you are part of the monster raving loony party. You know? I mean, how?
Sure. I mean, I think the thing is with that is when you look at how you get mapped. There's a bit of purposeful opacity on how you kind of enter this kind of constellation of opinion. So instead of, you know, putting you on these, you know, two or three axes and say, yeah, vote monster raving loony party, it's not saying, you know, your opinion is prone to violence and, you know, the strong use of force in diplomatic policy. I mean, they've actually purposely obscured that. So I think, you know, in some ways, they're trying to sort of encourage the exploration of opinion. Now, I think for me, it's not just if I were to say something that slightly critical about it, it would be that people who are already interested in foreign policy are going to gravitate to this. People who aren't necessarily engaged in those issues might not be encouraged to engage with them using this tool. So, you know, how do you get beyond the sort of, you know, foreign policy groupies?
I mean, the other element of it as well is, does crowdsourcing work for this kind of stuff? Do you want government by focus group or government by crowdsourcing? I mean, it works for some things, but what's right isn't always what's popular. And understanding what's going on behind the scenes is really important for foreign policy. You know, the delicate business of statecraft doesn't seem to be one of the things that you can apply the, a crowdsourcing model to me.
At the moment, Bobby, this is a site that's still relatively fresh. In fact, I believe, Kevin, it's still in beta, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, Bobby, do you think that when this is eventually released to the public, this will have any real effect on U.S. political foreign policy?
I find it hard to imagine that it will have a major direct effect. What I do think is important is that people don't stop doing these things because they get criticized, because somewhere along the line we might find a model that actually works and allows people to canvass opinion quickly and easily and well. We just have to find a way for that to scale and for politicians to plug into it.
They will have, you know, people quite high up, so I'm told, in the State Department respond to the most reviewed, the best reviewed questions. So there is going to be some feedback mechanism, I think. And what's interesting about this too is, you know, as Ari said, this isn't actually running on the State Department. It's running off on Berkeley servers because it was very difficult for them to kind of meet all of the regulations for state. So I think, you know, it's nice the way they've got it set up. It will be experimental, and I think we all know 1.0 operations are routinely, you know, interesting experiments, but not wholly successful by your goals.
Well, I eagerly await the results of this state-sponsored experiment to contradict my reservations about it. You can check it out and make up your own mind and then tell everybody about it on Twitter at state.gov/opinionspace. That's it for this week. Thanks very much to our guest, Ari Wallach from Opinion Space. Thanks to our pod team, Bobby Johnson in San Francisco and Kevin Anderson in the studio. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Scott, in the booth. Now, next Tuesday, we're hosting a live recording of the podcast at the Science Museum with online censorship campaigner Austin Heap. And we'll also be debating online identity and online privacy. So do come along. You can find out more at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Alex Krotowski.